I hope you're well and it's good to see you. Can you hear me well? Is my sound good? Okay. Good. And hello, bright ocean. I've been noticing some things. Today, the word gloaming came up for me, and I looked it up and noticed that in this next phase of a season, increasingly our meeting time in the evenings will be around the time of the gloaming, and that being the, and there was a time, like when I looked it up, it said, okay, in Colorado Springs, it said in Briargate, the particular neighborhood just north of me, the gloaming tonight was at 5:14 p.m. And I thought that was so funny to have a sort of moment defined as the moment where the darkness is just where the light is faint enough so that it just lights up the darkness. And, you know, you're seeing stars, but you're also seeing the last light of the sky. And I noticed, I think the reason I looked it up was because that particular time has been touching me so much lately. Something about the way, as the darkness comes on, the light has a kind of intensity and poignancy that just touches my heart. And I've been noticing a kind of leaning towards cleansing and purifying. Not in the sense of sort of thinking something needed transforming, or that I needed to sort of wipe the slate and start new, and, you know, anything sort of bold and foolish like that, but more a sense of a kind of releasing that just happens. I'm not causing a releasing, I'm noticing a releasing, and a taking care of, taking care of things, washing things, fixing things, mending things, sending things to the goodwill, offering things, but also just kind of touching things with my attention. And putting out peanuts for the jays and the magpies, and which turns out to be what Boxing Day is about, making offerings to people who are, and beings who are hungry, which I did not realize. But though that move, that feeling of a kind of purifying that doesn't have to do with perfecting anything, but that just feels like it's sort of built into the time. And also that deep sense of not knowing, not seeing, and wondering about trust. So Christmas morning, I decided, I'd been waking up, you know, early every day, but I decided to sleep in Christmas morning. And I was having a dream in which I couldn't open my eyes. And I kept trying, you know, I kept trying, and I couldn't do it, couldn't figure out how do you open your eyes when they won't open? And then the phone rang. And And I got up and picked up the phone, and lo and behold, my eyes were open. And to me, that there was something about that, about the just the, you know, when we say not knowing is most intimate, that feeling in the dark of really not knowing and not being able to do anything about it, right? It's not like, oh, I don't know, and it's fine. It's, I am not, I'm not able to know, not able to see. And yet, then life calls literally, and there you are. And it just made me laugh and feel grateful. And feeling, and this feeling of trusting somehow that the subtle powers of dark and light right now in the dawn and at the gloaming, and the way light feels like a sort of precious commodity, the sunlight, and so I kind of not exactly hoard it, but it's like, ooh, there's a patch of sunlight. I think I need to sit down in it, you know. I don't want to waste it. So a feeling of kind of the preciousness of the dark and the light, that's bigger than me. And if our practice, if what our practice does is to deepen our experience of the world, so that right within my experiences of ongoing failure, loss, frustration, I find more and more the experience of wonder, of poignancy, of curiosity, tenderness, determination. Then I don't have to define that as a transformation, because there's not something that must be transformed. It feels more like there, that our practice and the teachings of our ancestors and the companionship we have allows us to enter more and more deeply what is. And so this day, which is is celebrated some places as Amitabha Day, caught my interest as a connection with our story, with our koan. I think it touches on that, on the understanding in some way that all that's needed is not to refuse to enter. And that at every moment when I don't refuse it, openness just appears, is just here. And so Amitabha Day. So I looked up some things about Amida Buddha, and because so our in our story, our woman that we are keeping the inn probably is practicing Shin Buddhism, could very well be anyway. And I believe that Hakuin was speaking very much to people who were at the joining place of Chan and of Zen and Shin. So, and in fact, I learned that Shinran, the founder of the Shin sect, refers to Amitabha as the compassionate mother. I thought that was interesting. Apparently, devotion to Amida, the Buddha of infinite light, was present already in the first century before the Common Era, but in China and Japan became a school of its own. And the reciting of Namu Amida Butsu, which is the core practice of Shin Buddhism, was explained, at least by one teacher, as I entrust myself to the Buddha of infinite light and life. I entrust myself to the Buddha of infinite light and life. And it's explained as the call of Amida within you. So there's a kind of a call and response that's all happening in your own heart and mind. Amida calls, you respond. You call, Amida responds, until there's no distinction in that call and response. So in Jodo Shinshu, Amida Buddha is seen as a manifestation of true reality, of emptiness itself, of suchness. And the idea is that that Nembutsu, that chant, manifests Amida. It's not actually in that tradition a petitionary prayer. It's not asking for anything. It's not expecting something. It's a unification with. The act of saying it is an expression of your own Buddha nature. And because of that, two things follow. It's unique each time you say it, because that is this particular instance at this particular moment. And it's always there. So there's not a, you should be reciting so many of these a day. It's just that it's there and it will manifest in your heart and mind. So I was reading something from a teacher of that tradition, Mark Unno. And one of the things that his teacher had said to him really seemed to connect here for me, which was the more pure and white the emptiness at the center of a circle becomes, the blacker the line of the circle itself becomes. The more pure and white the emptiness at the center of a circle becomes, the blacker the line of the circle itself becomes. So if you're trying very hard to make purity happen, you're at the same time strengthening the barrier to freedom. And so that those practices are not about that, about attaining some purity. It will happen that you become attached to that light, to that experience of the light, which is so exhilarating. You can keep practicing and release that. So Shin also talks about other power, but Unno was speaking about that other power as not like you are praying to or you are asking something from some other, but more that you are discovering and touching that other which is central to your own being. And apparently, Unno was speaking of the confluence of Zen practice and Shin, and he didn't say this, but I remember learning that D.T. Suzuki, towards the end of his life, described himself as having studied Zen forever. Described himself as leaning more and more into Shin practice. Apparently, EQ at the end of his life said, "If people ask what is my opinion, tell them I also turned to Shin Buddhism." And Ryokan later asked for his death poem, said, "If someone asks if Ryokan has a death poem, just let them know, Namo Amida Butsu." So that was really interesting for me to see. Those are things I hadn't encountered before. And Unno's perspective was that Americans tend to want to relate to the tradition, to the Zen tradition, as a yogic path beyond devotion. And I sure have met that attitude a lot, that devotion is inferior. It's like for the people who can't quite cut it, you know? And that's a kind of shunning of your emotional life, can be. And so this story that I'm going to come back to in a minute, that I wanted to bring in tonight, feels to me so much like a kind of a way of speaking to that, and bringing those together, not a saying Zen is beyond that at all, but a kind of marrying of the devotional aspect and the yogic aspect of our practice. Unno expressed something I thought really well. He said, "We're not trying to get rid of emotional attachments. They can be deepened into wisdom and compassion." And I really loved that wording. They can be deepened into, not changed into, not replaced by, but they can be deepened into wisdom and compassion, our emotional attachments. That seems true to me. The passions don't become something else. They become more pungent, was his word. Isn't that delightful? Passions don't become something else. They become more pungent. So here is our sister in the Dharma. And it's so lovely, the beginning, it's just from beginning to end. So I'm just going to do a little meander in it, and then I'll open us up for conversation. So she kept the pilgrims in. That's a pretty constant, hard life of a job, huh? Heavy work, actually, keeping an inn. And I wonder what she noticed about the people who were the pilgrims who were coming and going. And I wondered about her own her own yearnings in her own life. I found a poem that I thought really might, maybe was touching on that feeling, or at least it did for me. And this is a poem by Jane Kenyon, Ice Storm. For the hemlocks and broad-leafed evergreens, a beautiful and precarious state of being. Here in the suburbs of New Haven, nature unrestrained lops the weaker limbs of shrubs and trees with a sense of aesthetics that is practical and sinister. I am the guest in this house. On the bedside table, good housekeeping and a nature reader. The others are still asleep. The most painful longing comes over me, a longing not of the body. It could be for beauty. I mean, what Keats was panting after, for which I love and honor him. It could be for the promises of God, or for oblivion, nada, or some condition more extreme, which I intuit but can't quite name. So I wonder if that might be what made our innkeeper go off to hear a talk by Hocklin, the local teacher, who said, "The pure land is your heart mind itself. Amida is your own body." Once Amida appears, mountains, rivers, earth, plants, trees, and forests all shine with a great light. If you want to see this, look into your own heart. Since the pure land is your heart mind itself, what kind of extraordinary features would it have? Since Amida is your own body, what kind of distinguishing marks would it have? You know, I imagine her feeling that kind of vibration of heart, mind, and body that can light us up when we encounter something incomprehensible and true at the same time, not knowing what this means, not knowing how does this meet me and my body that's getting pretty hard worked, my heart mind that's full of visitors and tea and breakfasts and laundry. And yet, completely subverting all of that, feeling that light, feeling that somehow the presence of that light that is that you can feel just in your body as a powerful vibration, or maybe vibration isn't even the word. To me, it always feels when that happens, it feels like lighting up, you know. And when she heard this, she said to herself, "This isn't so hard." And her life was probably pretty hard. And the "this isn't so hard" feels to me like the expression of just that energy of meeting it, right? That there's something's possible here. Something is possible. And there's some way in which I already know it, even though this makes no sense to me whatsoever. But so returning home, she meditated day and night, asking these questions while awake and asleep. Well, she was cooking and cleaning and doing laundry most of the time. And I bet she was pretty tired by the time she hit the sack. And so, is this some special deal? It doesn't seem like it could be some special deal, right? It's that this stuck with her, right? And it would just pop up. I imagine there she is, washing down the breakfast table, and it's there, There she is throwing the veggies in the pot, and it's there. The Pure Land is my heart mind itself. Amida is my body. There's a way in which that feels kind of backwards, doesn't it? The land, you would think of your body as land, I think. And Amida somehow has heart mind, but nah, he says, the Pure Land is your heart mind. That's the territory. That's the place. That's where it's at, the Pure Land. All of your complaints, all of your doubts, all of your frustrations, all of your sadnesses, all of your "I'm just going to fail again." Pure Land. And Amida is your own body. Your own body with its hungers and its fatigues, its requirements, its aches. Once Amida appears, what kind of distinguishing marks Pure Land of your heart mind? What kind of extraordinary features when you see it, when you meet it? And I wonder, it doesn't seem like she took those as rhetorical questions. It seems like she took those as questions. This isn't so hard. One day, as she was washing a pot, one of the things I love about the story is nobody told her she had to do anything, right? She just listened to his talk and went home and went, "I can do this." It's kind of wonderful. And so she's not, it doesn't feel like she's trying, she's just doing it, And pondering it day and night. So I had another association which was with co-counseling, and some of you have heard me mention this before. A co-counseling technique is to take the thing that you would wish would be true and you don't think it is, and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it to a partner who's listening. And it's not that you're convincing yourself of it or that you are changing your mind about it. It's that that's a way of releasing all of your distress around it. So, like saying, repeating again and again, the pure land is my heart mind itself. And finding what comes up, laughter, tears, you know, rage, sweating, shaking. Those are the kinds of things that come in that kind of release. If you really let yourself meet that statement and meet the resistance to it that is inside. So I wondered whether it might be like that for her as she was repeating those things to herself again and again through her days and nights, meditating on them. Or what kind of meditating on them she experienced. But there she was washing a pot, which is ordinary, but it's also washing, you know, it's water. And there's a kind of in your body, out of time thing that happens, at least for me, when I'm washing stuff. And as I mentioned, I've been feeling that impulse in this time. So anyway, she's washing the pot and she has a sudden breakthrough. She tossed the pot aside and went running to Hakuin, which is also kind of interesting because she didn't really know the guy, right? She just heard his talk. But you can feel how there has to have been a trust that was right there. There has to have been a recognition that he would know what to do with this. And she ran to him. And you can imagine he saw her coming, knew what was going on before she had to even open her mouth. And she said, "I've run across Amida in my own body. And everything on earth is shining with a great light. It's wonderful." And she's dancing because she can't help it, right? She's doing that dance that dances itself. And he's saying, okay, so you say, right? So this one translation, a different translation says, "Does it shine up your asshole?" This, the one that Joan put in here in her book, it says, "Does it? What about the cesspool? Does it shine with a great light too?" And of course, she waltzes right up to him and whaps him and says, "You old fart! Don't you know this already?" And they both just share the great laughter. So I was surprised and really touched and delighted to find that the talk given by Mark Unno was not in some different territory, coming from some different sort of belief system, at least as he was presenting it. It was this territory, I think, presented in a different way, but also really touching. Whose light? So in honor of Amida Buddha, this is not a statue of Amida Buddha, but it's the only golden statue I have. Somebody brought me from Thailand. So this one's on the altar tonight in honor of Amida Buddha. And could I be, let me see if I've, I don't think I managed to get it close enough. Anyway, I had a lovely picture of an Amida celebration altar, but I think it'll take too long to put it up. If we have time at the end, I'll find it and put it up. But now I'd like to just open up to conversation. What's it like for you right now, and does this have anything to do with it?
I kept thinking.